Good morning. Welcome to the panel for this Thursday, the 26th of April. Very nice to have you with us. And it's a very nice day. We thank you for being here. And we have a lot to talk about, so we'll get to it. There's just a lot of breaking news in the last hour, so we'll get to all of that stuff and much, much more. We welcome your letters, as always. Panel at WAMC.org. The music we heard coming in is The Mammals, our good friends Mike and Ruthie, part of that group, of course, and they're going to be playing the Egremont Barn in Egremont, Massachusetts on Friday night, tomorrow night. You can find out more by going to themammals.love. They also have a new album out called Sunshiner, so we'll be hearing their music this morning as we go in and out of our breaks, and that seems like a fine way to celebrate a Thursday morning. Now, let me introduce our panel to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning.
Hello, hello, hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hello.
Always good. Yeah. We're good. I think we can hear you okay? Yeah, we can hear Alan okay. Great. And communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Just fine, thank you.
Former publisher of the Daily Freeman newspaper, publisher emeritus is what we call him, and he is Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, sir.
Hello, Joe. Hello, everyone.
Very nice to have you with us. Also, Vera Carius-Kelly is with us. She is a Siena College professor of comparative politics. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. Okay, so let us get started. Again, it's panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your letters. What do we have to talk about? Well, we have quite a little bit. First of all, the president called Fox and Friends this morning and talked for a half hour, so there's a lot of news coming out of that. They're still putting it through the processor to find out exactly what he said, because it's hard to know on the surface when you... And you have
he has them on speed dial, doesn't he?
Yeah, you have the president and Steve Ducey speaking. Sometimes you need a translator. But so they're working on that. But we'll get to that in a minute. But the big news in the last hour is that the VA nominee, Ronnie Jackson, has dropped out after this string of accusations. Now, what is, to me, interesting, and the question I will pose to the panel is, that yesterday the second round of allegations came out that he had crashed a car while he was on the job, that when he was drunk, apparently, that there was the name of the Candyman prescribing opioids, Percocet to people, not properly, apparently. And all of these allegations were coming out. The White House still continued to batten down. He was very defiant. Ronnie Jackson was very defiant. Was on the morning shows this morning, was on CNN this morning saying, I'm in this. I'm staying in. I'm not going anywhere. Up until, well, an hour ago. So, what?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. So my question is, so then eventually... you see all of this coming down the pike. It just seemed like it was a matter of time. Then what happened?
I have two questions, and I don't mean them facetiously because I really don't know the answer. First of all, unless these events that are alleged to have happened regarding Jackson happened during the Trump administration and either they didn't know about it or looked the other way, I'm presuming this dates all the way back into the Obama administration. How is it that this guy is still the White House physician? Forget about that he was nominated for the VA. How did he hold his job as a White House physician in the midst of all of these things that were alleged to have occurred, presumably at least some of them, in the last administration? Does anybody know the answer?
I think I know a partial answer. Alan, do you know?
Oh, I know.
Go. Go.
Said Horshack. No. In fact, Ira, he was evaluated by the last two presidents before with great, who really liked him and said very important things about his competency. So it is interesting that as you get to that point in the Peter Principle, as you know, you go up the line, all kinds of stuff comes out that we would never have heard had he not been named for that job.
But also my understanding was that there was a degree of intimidation on other employees that was used, and it was not until this nomination that former employees came out to ask other current employees to try to block the nomination. That was my understanding.
But my favorite quote of the day, is he's walking along and the reporters are asking him a question. They say to him, what about this crashing in the car? And he says, I never crashed a car. That's what he says. I never crashed a car. So, he says, quote, we can discount that one. What do you mean we can discount that one?
Well, apparently he has a different interpretation of what crashing means.
Well, it could be. No, Vera, you're right. That could be. But on the other hand, I love the idea that by saying we can discount that one, you've left a lot of those that you haven't discounted.
Well, he seems to be self-assured and has a strong ego, that man, because, I mean, clearly he must have silenced his staff. When you think about the idea that somebody who can't apparently properly manage a staff of eight potentially could be assigned to run the Department of Veterans Affairs with, I think it was 780,000 employees. It's quite shocking. But coming back to Ira's comment, how did that information about Ronnie Jackson not emerge earlier?
Well,
had evaluations, but
I think the key point, though, is what you just made, Vera. Say all of these allegations are not true. I don't know if they're true or not true, whatever. But let's just put them in a box and put them aside. Even if you put those allegations in a box and put them aside to be determined later whether or not they're true, there's nothing in this man's resume that suggests that he has the capacity to run the second largest department in the United States government. And this is, you know, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. One of the things, you know, we got some letters saying that we were saying that the department, you know, that they don't deliver good health care. In fact, you know, they do. They've had problems. The previous administrator, Shulkin, who was an Obama appointee, who Trump carried over, the only one, by all accounts, they added necessary resources. They need more resources, but they added necessary resources. He was turning it around. Things were getting better. This is fundamentally a fight over privatization of the VA. So even if you put his problems, these allegations, in a box, he still is not the right person for this very important job. Our veterans deserve more. And this is a disservice. This nomination was a disservice to American veterans.
So I want to take a different view of this. There are those people who think that there are times that when a veteran can't get the service that they need at a veterans organization or at a hospital or one of those places, that they should be allowed to go to another place.
And that's already happening under the changes that they're making. Alan, I'm not saying you're making a specious argument. I'm saying that those who suggest that that's not happening now, it's just not true that it's not happening now.
They have a mixed system. That's right.
Privatization is a different thing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to be on record as saying that we want to be careful when we use words like privatization, not to exclude the idea that somebody can go to a better place or a place that serves.
Okay, I wanted to point something out about the services that veterans have received, and we have a number of veterans on our campus. So I've had conversations about this issue, and I learned that sometimes, I mean, obviously in the beginning, after a series of wars, we had a number of veterans, huge numbers of veterans coming back with absolutely debilitating injuries and needed very specialized treatment. The Veterans Affairs Department was not prepared for the number of injured veterans returning and being treated.
Because the Bush administration funded the Iraq War, but they did not fund the Veterans Administration to deal with it.
But I wanted to point out the following issue. Even though veterans now have, as you said, Teresa, the right to go to private hospitals or other medical facilities to get help, it doesn't mean that those facilities actually are prepared to deal with the types of injuries that we see within the military sort of background experience and injuries. So it does not I've learned from veterans that often they prefer to go through their medical care
to the VA.
To the VA.
They like the VA.
That is where they get the proper treatment now. When they go to other hospitals, they find that neither the counselors nor the staff is prepared to deal with the multiplicity of injuries nor the complexity of injuries. So this is not as easily stated as saying, let's just privatize and make everything accessible to veterans. This treatment that the veterans need and deserve is so specialized, for that a government agency like Veterans Affairs Department must exist and must provide specialized treatment.
Right. You want somebody who's going to continue to strengthen the VA.
Correct.
It delivers good care. It didn't have the resources that it needed. There were obviously problems that were uncovered. They were making improvements. And you want somebody to come in who's going to continue the progress forward, respecting the veterans and giving them the care that they deserve.
But to your point, though, this man, even if none of the allegations about him were true, he is patently unqualified.
He didn't have the skill set.
Yeah. So I wonder what he was drinking when he read the scale that said Trump is weighs 239. I have a feeling it was 329, but that's a sidebar.
Torrent of allegations that came out, 24 current and former colleagues from the White House medical staff raise concern over this nominee. So, in his statement, Ronny Jackson said, "Unfortunately, because of how Washington works, these false allegations have become a distraction for this president and the important issues we must be addressing, how we give the best care to our nation's heroes." He said that the charges were completely false and fabricated. Within moments, the president then winds up on Fox and Friends and goes after John Tester, the senator from Montana, who is the top Democrat on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, saying he would, quote, have a big price to pay, end quote, for undercutting Dr. Jackson. Mr. Trump said in his telephone call to Fox and Friends, he's an admiral, highly respected, a real leader, and I watched John Tester of Montana, a state I won by over 20 points. They love me and I love them. John Tester, I think this is going to cause him a lot of problems in his state. He took a man who was an incredible man, and smeared him.
What did he do? He quoted people who came to this committee and said this guy is known as the Candy Man because of the way he was frequently giving out pills. That wasn't John Tester's comment. That was information came to him.
And let's remember that the committee that he was supposed to, you know, have a hearing before is chaired by a Republican.
Yes.
And the Republican chair of the committee postponed the hearing and said that these allegations needed to be reviewed. A number of Republicans said the same thing. The White House did not vet this man properly for this job. And this is not, as the president said, after him, the Fox folks said this is the Obama administration's fault. Kellyanne Conway was on the TV last night saying, you know, he was vetted by the Obama administration. So
but
why
you can't
are you
have it both
us?
Ways, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you can't say
ridiculous.
That they're false allegations and then say, "Oh, but all of this happened on Obama's
watch." They don't have enough respect for governing, and for the expertise it requires to govern. They don't have a proper vetting operation, and this is what happens.
It's also astounding to me that when at first Jackson was nominated and he was initially introduced to, to members of Congress, I think he was escorted by a junior member of the publications office to be escorted over to members of Congress and the senators, which is also a sign that the entire structural operation in the White House is not focused on supporting their nominees, or they don't really think through the process, or they're lacking experience, right, or they don't have the staff.
The other thing that President Trump said this morning on Fox and Friends was this attack was because the Democrats were mad that Pompeo is getting through, and so they are attacking him because they're mad about Pompeo.
I think only he thinks like that.
But it's just ridiculous. I think what we have to do is keep focused on what's the problem now. Although he did say he has somebody in mind for this. The problem is now you have this vacancy at the top.
It's a really big problem.
And the problem is for the veterans. The problem is what happens to the veterans in all of this political commotion.
No. But the problem really is, is this president wants to name his physician, wants to name his driver, wants to name his pilot, as opposed to doing it right.
Right.
And speaking of the pilot, there's still no head of the FAA, right?
And meanwhile, and we're going to have to go to a break here, but meanwhile, I think Ira's point that he brought up at the very beginning of this segment is a really good one. So is this guy just going to go back to being the White House physician?
Apparently so.
And
well, that's a whole other issue.
Well, now that Rodney Dangerfield is gone, Dr. Vinnie Bumbatz is available.
I will say, though, that both the Bush administration and the Obama administration folks had said that they liked this guy, that he was a really nice guy.
I said that. I didn't say only nice guy. They really thought he did a good job. Right. I think you have to see that.
Right.
But what's interesting is that apparently they had no knowledge of how he treated his staff.
How could that be?
I mean, clearly somebody blocked that information from going up, right?
Right.
So I find that troubling, to be honest.
Military.
Throughout, the entire structure.
Well, there was one allegation, perhaps on more than one occasion, where at a hotel in the middle of the night, allegedly inebriated, banging on the door, and the Secret Service was concerned, among other reasons, that he would awaken the president and the first lady. How could that not have been transmitted to the president?
I guess it's the Secret Service that keep things like that secret.
Yeah.
They were in the same room?
Well, I think...
It was in the hotel hallway.
Yeah, but it was the last administration.
No. You didn't hear this.
No, I got you. I think it was the last administration.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. We'll be right back and continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We were just watching Paul Tonko, our very own, on CNN, talking about the Pruitt story, because Pruitt fears that the White House is undermining him ahead of the hearing. So Paul Tonko is speaking out on that. Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Alan Chartok is here, Teresa Bourgeois, Vera Akarios-Kelly, and Ira Fussfeld. And we have some letters. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to other stuff and to other stories, including the try to make just go through some of the points that were made on Fox and Friends this morning by the president of the United States. Let's begin with Brian, who says, to Alan's point regarding privatization, it is different from payments for out-of-network care, wherein private doctors are reimbursed for services provided on behalf of the VA. Out-of-network services, particularly in rural areas, are vital to the operation of the VA.
Thank you very much.
Sean says, ugh, I think you missed the point about Trump's attacks on the Montana senator. Trump made all of the nominee's problems the senator's problems success for Trump. I don't know that we missed that point, but
no,
okay.
I think you hit it right on.
Richard says, Shulkin was not the head of the VA under Obama. He was head of the VHS, Veterans Health Service. Rob McDonald was the head of the VA. McDonald was a West Point graduate and held high management. Held high management positions in the private sector prior to his appointment. McDonald had started on a major and somewhat successful effort to reorganize the VA. Unfortunately, he was not retained by Trump, who instead moved Shulkin over into that position.
My apologies if I got that wrong.
Richard says, this Cold War veteran loves VA service and care. No privatization, never had a problem. Thank you, Richard. Also, Vanessa says, my husband, an Iraq war vet, went through the VA for shoulder surgery. The surgery was performed at a private hospital in Saratoga County because we live outside of the Albany VA hospital service boundary. Veteran health procedures are routinely outsourced to non-VA hospitals. Hmm. The process was seamless with no hiccups.
So glad to hear that.
Mario says, would the panel please comment on Attorney General Schneiderman's effort to create a legal framework which would undermine the president's ability to intervene by pardoning witnesses? Are there further implications of undermining double jeopardy in New York which should be brought to bear? We have spoken about this in the past, but it is a story that is gaining traction. Alan, what do you think?
Well, you have a attorney general who wants to do what he should in order to protect the people from these pardons which are coming. Now, we do know, which I have always thought were coming anyway, we do know that there is a problem here. and that is that there are that there's this question of double jeopardy. On the other hand, you see on civil rights, for example, all the time, you see somebody gets off between a, before a Mississippi jury and they bring them up on federal charges, right? And they convict them. So double jeopardy, it depends on how the law is written. And I'm sure the Attorney General, Schneiderman, is a good man, is thinking all of that through and having his people think it through. And I'm sure he's getting some help, by the way, from some other people.
Anybody else? All right. I guess that's it for the letters. Okay, so let's go over to other things that are happening. And there we go. Let's talk about Michael Cohen for a moment. The president said today that actually was distancing himself a little bit from Michael Cohen.
That's Fifth Amendment Cohen.
Fifth Amendment Cohen. And drop the nickel. So, yes, there's that aspect of the story that Cohen went into the Los Angeles Superior Court, right?
Yes.
And pled the Fifth Amendment. However,
now that was a civil case.
Right. In the Stormy Daniels lawsuit to take the Fifth Amendment in that case.
And what he's saying, Joe, is that since the Southern District guy in New York, it has him up before the bar here, that he can't say anything because it might influence the way in which people thought about him or his legal troubles. So he's going to take the Fifth Amendment, which is every American's right. But as soon as somebody takes the Fifth Amendment, somebody else yells, "Who takes the Fifth Amendment except a guilty person?" That doesn't mean the Fifth Amendment isn't very important. It is. And we all remember McCarthyism and what happened during that time. But in this case, I think it makes him look even a little bit more shady.
And that somebody else is or has been the president of the United States who
repeatedly
during the campaign said people who were taking the Fifth Amendment, it's just like the mafia.
But I wanted to compliment Cohen because he actually listens to his lawyers in contrast to our president.
Well, Vera, you can go ahead and compliment
him. Yeah.
I don't count me as on your side.
It's just one of those sentences I didn't expect to hear.
It was just,
but it was interesting listening to Trump on Fox and Friends this morning where he said, you know, I had nothing to do with this. He has all sorts of businesses. I have lots of lawyers. And so they said, well, isn't he your lawyer? Well, he was my lawyer on this, how did he put it, on this Stormy Daniels?
On this crazy Stormy Daniels thing.
But this has nothing to do with me.
But by the way, this is also the first time, I mean, this is newsworthy, which it's the first time that the president acknowledged that his lawyer, Michael Cohen, represented him in this case in Stormy Daniels.
Correct.
It was the first time. He also said that the only thing that he had ever represented in with Stormy Daniels and distanced themselves that they had a prior relationship going back for years, not just in this case, but in many, many other cases, which, of course, is different than the story that has emerged of him being the president's fixer.
And
well, you know, there's always great to see the style. There ought to be a style book on what happens when your best friend or your closest guy or person turns out to be a crook. If that's the case, I would hesitate to say.
Well,
say
Trump said this morning he's a good person.
Yeah. Well, that's right, because he knows a lot about Trump. And so, you know, you have the case in New York State of the so-called third brother, Prococo, of Andrew Cuomo. And, you know, Andrew knew nothing about that. Trump knows nothing about this. What else are they going to say?
But how will Cohen react to Trump's behavior today? That'll be interesting.
I'm sure he won't say a word, right?
Exactly. I mean, he won't say a word. But I can't wait to hear Avenatti, you know, Daniels' lawyer, speak up on the entire issue, on the Fifth Amendment issue, on what
Trump
says.
He was all over the media last night.
Yeah, and he's coming out. I expect him to be all over the media today again.
Do you think he's overplaying his media appearances?
Maybe, Ira. I mean, there are days I think he's getting himself a little too far out and damaging his credibility. I think the guy's terrific, But I do think there are times when you say, okay, you've done it and you've done it well, now shut up.
Yeah, and he makes a lot of allegations that may well be true, and a lot of us who watch him hope that they're true because they're negative to Trump. But he throws a lot of stuff out there without any proof. And he might say, well, I'm saving it for the courtroom.
He did say he was on just moments after the president appeared and said that the president had made a hugely damaging admission. And then I just want to real quick just what the president said that on Fox and Friends this morning, saying this doesn't have to do with me. Michael is a businessman. He got a business. He also
He got a business.
Oh, yeah. I'm quoting. He also practices law. I would say probably the big thing is his business. I have nothing to do with his business. He is one of many members of my legal network. I have so many attorneys you wouldn't believe. And
yes,
asked much of his legal work, Cohen is responsible for, Trump said, as a percentage of my overall legal work, a tiny, tiny fraction.
When it was previously reported that it was the preponderance of Cohen's business, I don't know which is true, but it's been reported otherwise that the preponderance of Cohen's business was working for Trump. But the other thing that Trump said repeatedly is when asked about the Justice Department, oh, this is a witch hunt, and they said, well, you know, you run the Justice Department, you're the president, this is your administration. And he talked about the fact, well, with all this going on, I don't remember the exact words, maybe you can find them, Joe, but that he was going to stay away from the Justice Department, he was not going to intervene, but at some point he might. Mm-hmm. As if it wasn't the rule of law that he does stay away. I mean, there is a protocol here that the president does not intervene in the Justice Department's work.
When you say protocol, though, you mean norm. You don't mean there's a law.
Well, this is Trump the reality show president. This is Trump who will say regarding the Iran nuclear deal and what is it he's going to do? Well, you'll have to check with me on May 12th. Or I may or may not step in on the Justice Department. It all has the cliffhanger element to
it. Right. He always leaves that door open. Always says maybe in the future or I might. But he never says today.
But you said norm's not law, but what about obstruction of justice, Alan?
Oh, no, you'd be right. If it could be proven, he was obstructing justice by doing that. But the one thing that we see about, and I take great exception to this, I want you to know this line of yours here, that he has said all the things that are norms in the way we do things are out the window if they are not a law. Now, I think it's disgusting, but I think we have to understand that that's the distinction. This guy comes along and he says, just because that's the way it's always been done or that's the way it's always been understood, I do not agree with that, and I'm not going to do it. And it's awful, but it's what he does, and he's getting away with it.
But having the FBI director to dinner and asking him to take it easy on his friend Michael Flynn.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a violation of norms or law?
We will see. We're going to see.
I mean, are you suggesting, though, that that's just a violation of norms?
Would you be putting words in my mouth?
I asked you a question.
And I'm giving you an answer. Would you be putting words in my mouth? The fact of the matter is that the special counsel will be putting all of these together. In some cases, it might well mean, Teresa, that it was nothing more than a request. In some cases, it might mean that when you add the whole package up, you get a obstruction of justice charge. But there's a difference between obstruction of justice and just throwing out a norm.
All right. Well, and this is the same person, though, Alan, who during the campaign, when Bill Clinton met on the tarmac with Loretta Lynch,
right,
this then became a lock her up chant against Hillary Clinton because the former president spoke to his friend and former appointee Loretta Lynch for, what was it, 15 minutes or whatever, 20 minutes on the tarmac, reportedly about their grandchildren, but some people say no.
Oh,
it wasn't Hillary Clinton talking to, you know, it was Bill Clinton, and for that Trump felt compelled to say, you know, lock her up, and tainted the whole investigation. So is that a violation of norms or law?
Well, it may well have been a violation of norms. I don't know, and I don't know that you can say that he may have been talking about his grandchildren. You don't know.
What they were reportedly talking about. But what I'm saying is, on the one hand, Trump
says... I'd like to finish my sentence,
okay,
if I may. And that is that he walked over there. He shouldn't have, in my opinion. He knew what the risks were going to be. I'm not a defender of Trump, as anybody who listens to this radio station knows. But I think we have to understand the distinction between norm and law.
All right, let's take a pause there. When we come back, we will continue. We'll have more letters, we have more topics, and we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Akarios-Kelly. We will be back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. And just a reminder, we're hearing the Mammals, Mike and Ruthie, the main members, and their new album, Sunshiner. They're playing the Egremont Barn in Egremont, Massachusetts, on Friday night, tomorrow night.
That was great music.
Yeah, it is really nice.
Really nice.
TheMammals.love, that is their URL. So you can find out more, and we have the playlist posted on our website, WAMC.org. All right, let's go to other stories, other things making news. We will talk about the French President Macron charming both parties in an impassioned speech to Congress. The French president on Wednesday delivered a call for multilateralism and U.S. engagement in the world, saying it was an essential part of our confidence in the future. Speaking to a joint meeting of Congress amid frequent standing ovations and cheers, Macron recalled the long history of U.S.-French relations and the country's shared values and culture in the areas as diverse as democracy and freedom, human and civil rights, literature, jazz, and the Me Too movement. But he warned, this is a time of determination and courage. What we cherish is at stake. What we love is in danger. We have no choice but to prevail, and together we shall prevail. Much of what he said, although couched in stirring and global terms, posed a direct challenge to the Trump administration and to the U.S. president, with whom Macron said he had a special relationship.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating visit by Macron here to the, you know, to the U.S. and this sort of interactions with President Trump and sort of the messaging that has come out of the White House versus the contrast to his speech in front of Congress. So interestingly enough, I think Macron's message has been fairly consistent, although he played a role meeting with President Trump, and he has now set the stage for Chancellor Merkel, who's arriving today in the United States for various meetings and also to push this very similar agenda in terms of softening a potential economic blow on Europeans related to sanctions against steel and aluminum, although there are exceptions at the moment. The Germans are looking for additional wiggle room. The concern over the Iran deal is obviously foremost on Macron's and Chancellor Merkel's mind. The Europeans are deeply concerned about the kind of messaging that might send to Iran and a potential return to extremely hostile relations. They're trying to make a save. So all of what Macron did was coordinated with the European Union and certainly with Chancellor Merkel. So it was performance art with Trump at the White House, but the speech he gave in Congress was certainly the original agenda to which he returned.
Alan?
Well, he's got to thread the needle. We all know that. And he's doing that. And he's doing it well. He kisses the president on the cheek, causing a lot of people to think that that's extraordinary. And then he goes before the Congress and he stands up and he says what needs to be said. So and the Republican Congress. So I think, you know, he is a guy who feels that he has to play his role very carefully. I think he is playing it carefully.
But how do you square the apparent affection between these two guys? He did everything but French kiss him and then the repudiation in front of Congress, and that's essentially what it was. He talked about how nationalism doesn't work and globalism is the way to go, and that's not Donald Trump, his best friend, talking. So where do you think he – well, you tell me what – I don't quite know how to square that off.
Well, I think he knows that he can't afford to be an enemy of the guy. If he can get by being a friend, by kissing him on the cheek, by having the wives stand next to each other and pretend that they're all one big happy family, and then go before the Congress and say the exact opposite of what Trump believes, and if he can get away with it, he's become a magician.
But we also have to remember the messaging overall. I think Ira and I were talking about that during the break a little bit, that the reason why Macron returned to the essential themes that are most important to the Europeans is that the messaging also goes to domestic audiences in Europe. And Europeans are hypercritical of the Trump administration. So here Macron is returning to the fold, sending the messages that have been agreed upon, and whatever happens in private between Macron and President Trump is something entirely different from the messaging. And Trump understands messaging, and I'm sure they discussed that, who the audience is for the various
addresses. Interesting. That's interesting, Vera. So what you're saying, let me see if I get this right. What you're saying is that the messaging is what becomes more important. The way the whole thing looks is more important than the substance of the Macron position.
You remember when I think it was George W. Bush was president and Tony Blair was ridiculed in many of the British newspapers and editorial cartoons as being George W. Bush's pet dog. And he was because they people in England who did not like what was going on with Bush or with the war saw Tony Blair as being too closely aligned with him. And I think Macron had to be concerned that was going to be a similar reaction in France as a result of this bromance that they were. I mean, he held Donald Trump's hand more this week than Melania did. So, there's this. He needed to speak to the Congress in such a way that his people at home would not think he was in Trump's hip pocket.
But I think substantially, one of the most important things that Macron did is give Trump an out to not renege on the Iran deal and create this separate, begin negotiating this separate side agreement, which because there is a strong desire that he not renege on May 12th on the Iran deal, and so he gave Trump a path forward on that. He delivered an option that provides a path forward. So that is very substantive. And I think much of what he talked about yesterday in this joint session of Congress, if people didn't listen, go to C-SPAN and listen. It was fantastic. But even when he was very hard-hitting substantively on the Paris Agreement. And, he said, one day I know the U.S. will return to the Paris Agreement. He was substantive on the fact that Europe, you need to negotiate with Europe jointly, cooperatively, that you're not going to do single deals. He was very, firm on that. On a whole host of policy issues, he was very firm. But I think most importantly, substantively, is giving Trump a way to continue the Iran deal, but keep talking about these other issues that he wants to raise that were not in the deal.
And Macron was the only one who could deliver that message,
right?
Because obviously what we already see is a White House completely differently preparing for the arrival of Chancellor Merkel. No state dinner, no special addresses to be given. The meetings are short. They're not going to be warm and there won't be much press interaction. It'll be very formal, rigid. And possibly even Trump is expected to be quite critical of her. And then she will likely remind President Trump of the fact that, not only is it to the benefit of Germans to sell German cars here, but that the supply lines are all interconnected and that we have about 600,000 jobs related to the German car industry in this country that could be lost if there are disruptions in trade in that way. So I think the messaging between Trump and Merkel will be entirely different, and Macron was the only one
who could deliver
on sort of messaging about Iran, about the unity of Europe, and you don't want to mess with the idea of having Europe in the hostile camp.
Let us take a break. We'll go over to news with Ray Graff, and we will continue after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here, Vera Akarias-Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning and welcome. We got a lot going on, so let me get to a couple of letters, and then we will move into some other stuff here, including the what's been going on with the Supreme Court and travel bans and all of that. All right. Roger writes, good morning, panel. Numerous scandals with Pruitt, Jackson, and Cohen are now combined with the Russia investigation. Trump's misogyny and treatment of women, his constant undercutting of cabinet and other officials in his son's real estate deals. Is this the fake news that Trump calls the enemy of the people? Or is it a free press courageously reporting factual information revealing the Trump administration as the most corrupt president in history? Now, Macron and Merkel are the de facto leaders of the Western world. Alan.
Well, look, things are what they are. It keeps getting worse for Trump, but it doesn't bother him at all. In fact, I think he enjoys it because, as we've talked about so many times on the air, bright, shiny objects and other things detract from people paying attention to the overall philosophy of Trump and also to the specific problems that he's having legally. So, you know, I don't know that it shows that he is all that concerned with all of these investigations.
Vera, are Macron and Merkel the de facto leaders of the Western world?
Well, I mean, I think as a European, I would say they certainly are interested in filling perhaps, well, at least Chancellor Merkel might try to fill sort of the rational legal kind of leadership of the world, whereas Macron also is quite willing to use some of the military, fill some of the military gap, but it still is difficult for Europeans to lead the world. I think the United States is sort of expected within the, you know, Western-oriented, highly developed union of states is expected to lead in that sense. And obviously now there is this vacuum that is slight. It's filled in part by France and Germany, but I don't think it's fully, you know, taken over the leadership.
I think you're right, Vera. I think that's exactly right.
One of the things I thought was interesting that Macron said yesterday in his speech was he talked about the corruption of information erodes our democracy, democracies. And I thought when he was talking about fake news, and I thought that he was particularly pointed on that issue of truth and the attack on truth.
I didn't bring my notes from the other studio, but we just recorded the Media Project, and much of it was about a report from an organization called Reporters Without Borders.
Right.
This was the same report that said the United States is now 45th in the press freedom list, Norway number one, North Korea last. But it's generally the comment was, and please listen to the beginning because I read the report verbatim, the fake news tag and which was largely promulgated by Trump has had an incredible impact on how people around the world, not just here, view news organizations and journalists. Mm-hmm. And it's very damaging. Forget about what I might want to say self-servingly about journalists and our institutions. It's just bad for the world if we can't believe what a fair and as honest as possible press is reporting. And I think we have a situation now with Trump and his base and his supporters, which I like to call controlled chaos. And by that, I mean he has laid the groundwork by repeating fake news and you can't trust them and obstructionist Democrats, all of these various accusations, many of which are lies. And he has ingrained them in the brains of his followers. And to the point where when he talks about fake news now in a speech, speech, people just sort of shrug. Oh yeah, that's right. I mean, it's in our head. Not all of us, but many people in this country have been hypnotized by this guy.
But I don't.
By the way, I know Alan, with justification, likes to say he was one of the few people who said Trump had a chance to be elected. I pride myself on one prediction, on one thing that I said, and this prediction to follow. I believe I was one of the first who was willing to say Trump is a pathological liar long before anybody else was saying it. But I believe, and I've been saying this for quite some time, probably here too, that I don't think Trump's going to run for re-election.
Well, I hope not.
I think he's going to declare victory and leave the stage.
I just want to follow up on another organization that people might want to check out called Transparency International, which is an organization, a nonprofit that watches the sort of corruption patterns inside countries and does surveys on an annual basis and prints reports, online reports that are available for free. The United States in that area has also slipped in the ranking. So overall, when we combine all these types of reports and put the puzzle together, we really are looking like we're sliding in the respect and in the way we are perceived by many countries all over the globe.
I don't think there's any question about it.
Yep.
It's interesting today. I mean, you think about how Trump decided to use his 30 minutes on Fox today. He's just come off of what some could argue is a very successful visit from Macron, right, that he could tout. It's out in advance of the German chancellor coming and the North Korea-South Korea talks. You have Pruitt, important hearing from his secretary of EPA today. Mm-hmm. And so you would think he might have used that time to, you know, tout his wonderful visit with the French president, that you talk about all the great things that they have done at the EPA, because for his, you know, from my mm-hmm. point of view, they are not good for ourselves or our future generations, but for his constituency, it's a lot of success there. You would have thought that he would talk about his upcoming meeting with North Korea and South Korea and such. But instead, he used that 30 minutes to, you know, talk about all sorts of other personal
things. It's attack mode, right, Teresa?
Right, but you know, where that doesn't establish him as a global leader.
Right.
You know, those topics that he chose to focus on right. aren't topics that, you know, taking on Comey or taking right. on the whole Stormy Daniels issue, that does not keep the message. That's not on message.
Well, I don't know how you would measure or how you are measuring the success of this meeting with Macron. I don't consider it successful. I mean, so much of this world today, rightly or wrongly, is based on image and optics and whether or not you're being made fun of by the evening TV people. The images that come out of this meeting this week with me are the bromance, which we've joked about here already, and that's the point. Everybody's been joking about this image. He just fawning over this guy. The relatively minor, but nevertheless an image of that makes you not forget some of the other problems he's having, that the ice between Melania and the president is palpable. The fact that the state dinner was selectively, the guest list was selective to a fault, that the fault being no Democrats, as Teresa pointed out off the air, Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, not invited to a state dinner, period. I don't even have to say because it was.
She didn't attend. We can only presume she wasn't invited.
I can't imagine
she said, I'm playing
poker tonight. So, so you know, and then, as we've already discussed, despite this love affair between the two, then he gets up in front of Congress and essentially repudiates the Trump doctrine. So if Trump wants to call that a success, well, I guess, you know, in Trump's world, up is down and down is up. So.
Can I make a forecast? Because the two of you, or multiple of you, spoke about
how... Yes, Karnak, put a card on your head.
So I wanted to say Nikki Haley looks really good as a VP next time.
I think I could see her running a primarying Trump. There are a lot of people in the Republican Party who are being very quiet about whether they support this president, and I suspect that he's going to have one or more challenges.
All right, we got this letter from Daniel, and then I want to move on to the Supreme Court. Given the authority, power, and influence of the president, and considering the intimate setting, it seems pretty clear that Trump's request to Comey constitutes obstruction. Had the request come from a citizen without the aforementioned factors, it is the request would be viewed much differently. Wield power carefully is the key here. Trump cannot claim ignorance of this rule. All right, let's go to the Supreme Court, SCOTUS on the travel ban, and key justices seem skeptical of challenges to Trump's travel ban, according to this article in the New York Times. A 15-month legal battle over President Trump's efforts to impose a ban on travel to the United States from several predominantly Muslim countries reached a final stage on Wednesday at the Supreme Court, with its 5-member conservative majority signaling it was ready to approve a revised version of the president's plan. The justices appeared ready to discount Mr. Trump's campaign promises to impose what he repeatedly described as a Muslim ban, while giving him the benefit of the doubt traditionally afforded to presidents. Some expressed worry about second-guessing executive branch determinations about who should be allowed to enter the United States. Immigrant rights groups had hoped that Chief Justice John Roberts or Justice Anthony Kennedy would join the court's 4-member liberal wing to oppose the ban as unconstitutionally discriminatory against Muslims, but their questioning was almost uniformly hostile to the ban's opponents.
No question. Kennedy is the guy. He's the switcheroo guy, and he's going with the president on this, so it's over.
So can I ask a naive question, Alan, then, which is, how is this not discriminatory?
Well, I'm not going to defend it. I'm certainly not going to defend it. But the fact of the matter is that if you count in what he said before he was elected president, then it certainly is discriminatory. He talked about Muslims, no question. Whether they decide that that's what they're going to do is another whole question. All I'm saying is, when you look at the way those questions were being asked from the court, I'm not approving of it, of course. It is clear to me it's going to be a 5-4 decision.
No, I agree with that. I understand that. I'm just wondering, like, how does the court come to that decision? I mean, when this was originally made as a campaign promise, everybody said, oh, my God, this will never go anywhere because it can't possibly be legal. But if you say you, because of mm-hmm. this, can't come into the country, I'm just wondering how that does not come off as discriminatory.
Well, go look at American history. You'll see Japanese, Italians, other people being discriminated against during the Second World War and other places. I'm not arguing for it. I'm simply saying that what the court is going to do is say, this is a presidential prerogative. We're out of it.
I thought that the Chief Justice that was reported, I didn't listen to the arguments mm-hmm. I just read, and he one of the questions he has is Trump, will he forever be unable to address immigration in light of his campaign statements? Quote, is there a statute of limitations
exactly.
on that?
Yeah.
And I thought that was a very...
That was a strong indicator, right, for the positioning, because if you always take every utterance by the president as discriminatory, then he could not ever make another comment on border security towards, you know, Mexico. And so basically they're disregarding, discounting the long-term effects of what President Trump has articulated in his campaign speeches and his personal expressions, and that's different from being, implementing policy, in fact, is what
that's
they're arguing.
Right.
And even if wherever the courts come down on this, the fact yep. is that they have de facto implemented a ban because, mm-hmm. you know, if the data shows far fewer people coming into this country. Mm-hmm. And you know, the other issue was, you know, 50 predominantly Muslim countries in the world, only 5 Muslim countries are on
right.
the list. But there are 5 countries on the list.
But they also added Venezuela, and they have North Korea on
right.
there. So it's
I think
not,
they figured out how
know,
to thread the needle
exactly.
on that. What was it,
yeah.
the third try?
The third try.
Third try.
So I think on the third try is a charm.
But the implication, the long-term implication, if in fact the court upholds mm-hmm. this travel ban, I think one of the questioners on the court raised the issue of, well, what happens if some future president, I'm paraphrasing now, mm-hmm. has it in for some other country who we currently don't view as a potential risk?
Mm-hmm.
Does this mean that a ruling that we might give on this issue will allow the president one to four administrations down the road to say there is precedent for me to do this. And I think the answer is yes.
Yes, and that's it's obviously a deep concern because then we have to be really careful of about how we define what is national security and how we enforce it. I mean, this is something that each administration has battled over in terms of what's included in that, how to define, what a country needs to do to protect itself, and our economic concerns part of national security, as the Trump administration has now argued, and there's so many variations on that. It's quite frightening to somebody like me to look at it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Does it give those of us who might choose to identify ourselves as moderates to liberals? Does it give us any solace if, in fact, the decision does go to uphold the ban, that Kennedy, presumably the swing vote, in fact, was the swing vote and voted in favor? In other words, do we have more confidence in Kennedy as an honest broker who is not a knee-jerk one way or the other? And if this is the way he decides, well, okay, we can live with that. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I don't know that that calms me down in any way. I'm expecting a very, very upsetting ruling from the Supreme Court.
I mean, Kennedy could go this way on this particular case, mm-hmm. and then next week he could go in a way that we might be more approving on another matter.
But the damage has been done, though, don't you think?
Well, it's been a lot of damage by Trump. Just in general, by what his comments on Muslims and Mexicans.
And they weren't, singular comment or episodic. I mean, this is...
No, it's a pattern.
It's a theme. It was a key campaign theme.
It's done on purpose. The messaging is clear.
But also, we are seeing other immigration policies from this president under challenge, going through the courts. Mm-hmm. And so we wonder if this is a precursor to that and ultimately what would happen on DACA.
I mean, the DACA issue is obviously very interesting as well. They have 90 days now. Homeland Security has 90 days, from what I understand, to explain its policy towards restricting DACA.
Yeah, I'm not sure DACA would go in this same way, though. Do you think?
Well,
I
do not. I think you're right.
I sure hope not. I think there's a stronger pushback.
Right.
I
think you'd have
area.
a different set of questions in a
discussion
of DACA than you have here.
I sure
because
hope so.
They have made changes. They have threaded the needle, perhaps, and found a way to make this to get.
And
the
you have a president, and Teresa, you have a president of the United States. Who said he sympathizes with the DACA people and he wants them to stay, even though, of course, he's playing the other side for the base. So, there's an awful lot of room for people to argue that this is one, and the people on the court to say, well, if the president says it's okay, it's okay.
Let's go to the final story this morning, and that is the Golden State Killer case. This is... really quite an amazing story.
Unbelievable.
We found the needle in the haystack. A Golden State Killer suspect arrested after sudden DNA match. This is a case that has been going on for more than 40 years after the so-called Golden State Killer began terrorizing California, raping dozens of women and killing at least 12 people. Authorities announced Wednesday that they had arrested 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo, charging him with capital murder after a recent DNA match. His arrest in Sacramento offered a shocking abrupt development in what had long been one of the most notorious unsolved string of crimes in U.S. history. The gruesome attacks unfolded across California for more than a decade during the 70s and 80s, shattering families and frightening communities. Then the crime stopped, remaining a mystery for a generation with little sign that the case would ever be solved. The trail suddenly and ultimately led authorities to DeAngelo, a former police officer living in Citrus Heights, a city outside of Sacramento. Authorities said DeAngelo, who was an officer during the years when police believed the attacks began, was found through DNA evidence obtained in recent days. Though investigators declined to elaborate on what the DNA evidence was or how it was obtained, they said it clearly linked him to the crimes that had transfixed them for several decades. That's a cold case.
I smell movie.
But I mean, think about all those women that were brutally raped by that man and had to, for decades, just deal with the fact that the guy that did that to them had not been captured. And now the moment of this announcement, it must have been incredible. Also for the families of those that had been murdered by him. What a horrible, horrible man. And now, finally, some answers. I think that is incredible work.
You have to applaud the diligence of the police in this case.
That they made this commitment to really search and look and
years
use and retest the DNA and look for all ways to find the guilty party.
Alan, you had a question for Vera?
Yeah, no, Vera, so what do you think ought to be done with this guy? He's 72 years old. Put him in prison for a couple of years and he dies. Meanwhile, all this misery you're just talking about, the murders, the rapes, you know, is that enough?
Well, I mean, in my mind, all victims deserve a trial. They deserve to find out everything about this man. There has to be a public trial. There has to be punishment. Now, I happen to be opposed to capital punishment under all circumstances. So to me, prison is it.
I agree with you, Vera.
Yes, ditto. Life without parole.
Life without parole.
Yeah.
And what did I say? 72, right?
72, yeah.
There's also the Patton Oswalt connection here, which is
a little obscure.
Really interesting. That
this person's wife wrote the book.
Right. So this is a comedian, a very popular comedian, whose wife actually was, do I have this right, was sort of the one who coined the phrase.
I think so.
Golden State Killer. And she had been working on this project, and she had a very untimely death at the age of 40-ish, yeah, and died while pursuing the Golden State Killer. So this book comes out, and then, of course, just a few months, almost a year later, he is caught. It is that's quite a part of the story. As well, Mr. Oswald told people yesterday that he believed the killer would be caught soon. This was when he was talking about the book. And he said the news of Mr. D'Angelo's arrest feels deeply personal. His late wife, the writer Michelle McNamara, had spent the final years of her life chasing the Golden State Killer, hoping to identify him in her book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. But Ms. McNamara died before she could see the killer brought to justice or her book published. So another fascinating aspect
Absolutely.
Of the case.
And talk about great police work. If you haven't read the story yesterday about the Toronto cop and who asked
him
when he arrested.
Oh, look at that.
Well, I love that. Ought to be a primer for every cop in every country that when in handling a case like that.
So Agreed. Brave. Yep. So brave. It's hard to be a police officer.
All right. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody. And we will, Alan, good to hear you. Feel better. Vera, Ira, Teresa, thank you all very much.
Thank
you. We'll be back.
Thanks for
listening. We'll be back right after this.